It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Native.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. 14-1 is a section of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act providing for the selection of culturally significant historic and archaeological sites in the various regions. The first phase of implementation was the nomination process. In Southeast, that was done through an outside consulting firm. Now, the Cooperative Park Studies Unit at the University of Alaska is working on phase two, which is on-site documentation. In Southeast, that means looking around and asking questions about some 96 the Alaska sites. Russ Sassett is a research associate with the CPSU. He's been working in Southeast, and he describes how the research teams approach the job.
Hopefully, our research starts before we get into the field. What we would like to do is be able to sit down and do a brief archival library search on each site, obtaining historic documentation of early exploration in the area that may have visited the site. If there's any other anthropologists or archaeologists or anyone else that has done any type of research in the area, whether or not they had visited the site and what they'd done with the site, so that when we go in the field, we'll have some idea of what the importance of the site was, what we can expect to find there. In addition, it's hopeful that we'll be able to interview some of the informed people in the area that may have had relatives that lived at the site. In Southeast Alaska, most of the sites we're dealing with were permanent villages up until the early 1900s, and when they were abandoned. So many of the older people in the Southeast have either lived in the site or have visited the site or had relatives. So there's just a lot of information that can be obtained from people. And it doesn't always work out, but we would like to be able to interview these people before going into the field and getting a better feeling of what we're going to be looking for. And once we arrive at the site, it's basically doing a transect of the site, just walking over the site, identifying different cultural features, smokehouses, old ruins of houses, cemeteries, middens, anything you'd associate with human activity. And then once we have identified that cultural material, we can sit down and start deciding where the site boundaries are, for the conveyance purposes, we have to delineate the area of the site, and we take in consideration the cultural activities, what the site was used for, whether it was just a seasonal village or a permanent village or a subsistence camp. And then along with that, we take in consideration of visual integrity of the site, which kind of takes in the realm of, why was the site located here in this part of the bay and not, someplace else, the physical features that it had to offer. And so with those two things combined, we try to, delineate where exactly the area of the site is.
What are some of the other kinds of sites, villages or camps would be, that's easy to visualize, probably easy to justify including, but do you have other things that...
Well, the sites in Southeast Alaska range from, we have one site that's been selected that's prehistoric, and it was excavated by Robert Ackerman of Washington State University in the mid-60s. That's the Groundhog Day site, too. That dates approximately 10,000 years ago. Fortunately for us, it was a permanent village site that was occupied up until approximately the 1920s before it was abandoned. So there's a lot of surface evidence of the village, and basically our program is just to identify the sites and, you know, say that they do exist. And in the cases where there's a lot of surface evidence, then we don't get into archaeological testing. If there weren't any surface evidence, then we do archaeological testing. So that's the case. That's one example of one of the sites that's prehistoric, you know, dating back 10,000 years and goes up into the 20th century. Then we also have quite a few petroglyph sites and pictograph sites. And they tend to be smaller. They're an important site in Southeast Alaska because there's really not that much known about, you know, who carved the petroglyphs, why were they carved, and what do they really represent. There's a lot of, you know, speculation as to, and some of the features, or some of the petroglyphs are known ethnographically and why they were put there. But for the most part, they're beyond ethnographic information. Ethnographic is basically just the material you obtain through interviewing the older native population or people that are familiar with the area.
So through the stories or people that may have witnessed, you know, that
or may have even done it. In the case of the one petroglyph site, there's one specific petroglyph. There's a number of petroglyphs at the site, but there's one that's of a tina or a copper shield, which is known ethnographically, although it's before any of the living people today when it was carved. It's known ethnographically because of a specific in the Angoon when there was a disturbance between two clans, and then the one clan had to vacate the area and move out. And when they moved, they carved this petroglyph at the site as a representation of the wealth that they were giving up to this other clan. So in cases like that, there is some ethnographic material, but for the most part, the petroglyphs are before the present population. And a lot of them are pretty pointed, so there's not that much information on them.
There's still a lot of work yet to be done.
Oh yeah, I think for the most part the Southeast has been somewhat overlooked archaeologically. Ethnographically, there's been a lot of work, mainly in the 40s and in the early 1900s. But archaeologically, it's probably one of the more overlooked areas of the state.
I think that Southeast is being fairly well gone over because it's always the first to be hit from the move.
Ethnographically, it's really been hit, and even today, there's a lot of people going through collecting stories and the history of the area, and that proves a little somewhat of a problem for us, because in a lot of cases, the people are being ripped off for their material. They go in and give their stories and their histories to the people, to writers and other people. Not in every case, but I think it happens enough.
And then tired of it too.
They're probably tired. I don't know if they're tired of it, but what happens is that a lot of people will go and publish the material, and the people that they collected the information from really sees no reward or anything from that, and so it takes a while. Sometimes it's no problem for us, but a lot of times we'll have to just establish a trust between the people and, let them know exactly what the material is being used for, that it's not being used for publication or, my financial welfare, and that in the end it will be a benefit to them because to the material that's collected from them, it's needed for conveyance purposes to establish the importance of the site within their heritage.
Is this training mostly in archaeology or more scientific end, or do you have a cultural training as well, knowing a little bit about the culture you're going into and maybe how to behave or how not to behave and some of the things that could be important?
I've gone through an anthropological program, which is archaeology under anthropology, and through the courses and all, you get a general feeling for how to conduct yourself But I don't think you can really get anything like that in a classroom situation. I really didn't learn doing that until you actually get in the field. Nothing's really textbook perfect. I think the first year that I was doing it, I was probably a little hesitant about it just because of going into an area that my knowledge wasn't really that up. Under this program is the first time I've really had to conduct in-depth interviews with people. So it took me a couple interviews to really get down and realize how the people conducted themselves. It's a little different than how my sitting here and talking to you. It's not that big a difference, but after a couple of interviews, you become more relaxed and you kind of let the people do more of the talking and just ask the pertinent questions. And I really enjoy doing it. It's probably one of the more enjoyable parts of the job for me. And I find that the older people that I talk to, once they trust you and get to know you more, really enjoy having someone to listen to. They enjoy talking to someone that's willing to listen. And they're just really a wealth of information for the search we're doing. Makes the job a lot easier.
Do you get any problems with ownership of areas, with clans saying, this is ours, or people feeling that their ancestors, were on the site and therefore it's really theirs and not?
Yeah, you get that a lot with the older generation. They traditionally view it as their land, and because of the circumstances of why they left the land, they don't really feel that they've given up ownership. It's still their clan's ownership. And one of the tougher questions that they ask you occasionally is, why are you conveying this land to us? We already own it. How did we lose this land? And that's a hard question to deal with when you're talking to the people. And sometimes I go into an interview hoping that they don't ask me that question. I find it a hard question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
And, so hopefully I can
smooth
over that answer. Say I don't know, and hopefully get through that and get into the interview.
Russ Sackett and the other Cooperative Park Studies Unit researchers make an effort to get the information they gather back to the villagers. That's not always possible, but the reports are generally accessible through the regional corporations. I'm Paula Schiller. You've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller with a third part of a series looking at how the Cooperative Park Studies Unit at the University of Alaska back to this 14H1 site. 14H1 is a section of ANCSA which entitles the regional corporations to select historic sites. Working last summer in the Prince William Sound area were Jim Marcotte, who you will hear later, and Jim Ketz, who described some of what they encountered.
It's kind of an isolated area, so there's a lot of logistical problems dealing with weather and boats and that kind of thing. It's also dealing with people. It takes some certain skills that you don't learn in the classroom, too. And so it really requires a lot of, like you said, things that you don't learn in the classroom to do well. We haven't had any major accidents so far. We've had some
few mishaps,
but nothing really serious that jeopardized either life or limb.
Boating mishaps,
we haven't gotten lost. We know the area pretty well, and it's pretty straightforward. We're dealing with islands and coastline, so there's not too much of a chance of getting lost. Weather has been a problem. Last spring we had, when we were first out in the field, we had a tremendous gale come whipping down from the mountains on us and flattened our camp.
Mm-hmm.
Tents, and these are the huge tents that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has supplied. We're sailing off down the beach, and we're standing, this was at night, we ended up standing out in the rain and the wind in the underwear. So, weather is a problem.
Does that, the kind of weather you encounter, help you give any insight to what you're uncovering? Does it all relate to the kind of thing that you might be digging up?
I think so. A lot of the serious storms come out of the southeast. It's a set pattern, and that does have its implication on where the sites are located. Many of the village areas are such that they're protected from the southeast winds.
How old are some of the sites?
That's one of the interesting things about this area is that that Chuyak Natives Incorporated, who identified the sites initially, selected a wide range of sites, wide range in terms of the time period that they represent. So not only do we have some important prehistoric sites, but we've got some important sites that go through the entire historic period in Prince William Sound, which dates back to Cook's voyage in 1778, and I think that we're gonna look on Kayak Island, which is Bering's landfall, and maybe look for some of the sites that Steller and a few of his scientists on board that voyage have described.
Have those kinds of things been selected?
Yes. There's no site per se that's going to represent the what Cook described in 1778, but I believe that we haven't seen all the sites come through pre-adjudication yet, but some of the sites on Kayak Island supposedly represent that time period, 1741, what Bering or what Steller described there when they made their landfall. So it's, and then we move into more recent, the Russian period, for example. Nuchek, I think, illustrates that time period. It's the site of the Russian Redoubt, and the Nazi Russian, it was the site of the last commercial company station. And there are other sites associated with that time period. So we've got sites that represent the whole fur trade era, which is a fascinating thing in and of itself.
You're talking about sites that have really statewide interest.
For sure.
Does that complicate things or make it easier?
It makes it complicated because, to some extent, because people want to see that significance within the broader context of Alaska history, which is certainly valid. But then they tend to overlook the fact that it was people who were living in the Sound at that time that made this whole thing happen. It was really the Native people of Prince William Sound that were the support of the entire fur trade.
which I think tends to be overlooked in terms of the broader significance of the North Pacific exploration or the Russians in Alaska, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're about, I think, is documenting Native history. We want to emphasize that perspective.
I'm not sure how well populated Prince William Sound is now. What are Cordova and...
Cordova, Valdez, Whittier, Seward, not really in the Sound itself.
Are those places, though, those are towns like Whittier?
Whittier is essentially a white,
yeah.
White community. Valdez, I think it's essentially white. There's a sizable Native community in Cordova.
But then the towns that exist now correlate to older villages or older sites?
Tepetlik does. I think at least there's a continuity in the name, if not the exact location, although the present village site seems to be in a general area where there's continuity back through the entire historic period. And there were only a few major villages in the Sound from what the earlier explorers were able to determine. Tepetlik being one of them.
So it must have at one time been more populated than it is now, I'm just guessing, with all this activity.
Well, that's a very interesting research question. Comparatively speaking, compared to the Kodiak Islands, for example, some of the other coastal areas of Alaska, from what can be reconstructed from the historical accounts, it seems that the resident population in Prince William South Sound was extremely low.
Mm.
And that's going to be a major, I think will be a major research question to determine exactly why that is, why that seems to have been so, whether there were some climatic variables happened during the more recent period, comparable to the retreat of the glaciers in Glacier Bay, for example, whether there was something comparable happening in Prince William Sound, or whether there is something about that local environment that precludes a large population being there.
I was wondering if any of those things that you might have been speculating on in your travels there.
Oh yeah, that seems to be a constant source of speculation on our part when we're out in the field. We don't have any answer for it. We've been dealing with, or at least had contact with biologists working out in the area, and we always hit them with those kind of questions, like what was the carrying capacity? What is the carrying capacity of Prince William Sound in terms of the marine life in Prince William Sound, and getting into discussions about that type of thing. I don't know if it's going to take a little bit more effort to come to any kind of conclusions about the reason for that, but it will be an interesting one to deal with.
You've talked about different sites. Are there any sites that are particularly only Native sites? We've talked about the ones that may have statewide interest with the Russians and the refrigerator and Captain Cook and some of the prehistoric sites.
Sure, Jim Genoa.
We have quite a few sites like that.
You just have to describe them because I have no idea.
Okay. A common site type that we find in Prince William Sound are smokehouse sites. And these are locations where the Chugach had smokehouses where they put up the fish for the winter. And on the order of 4,000 to 5,000 fish might be put up for an extended family group for the winter. And smokehouses are commonly located right at the mouth or very close to the mouth of a salmon stream.
Mm-hmm.
One noted for having a strong salmon run year to year. We found an interesting function of its smokehouses was that it was a marker for the right to use that salmon stream. And so it was in fact like a resource use or in effect ownership marker for it. Other site types and smokehouses, hunting cabins scattered throughout the sound. A lot of just seasonal resource sites, such as an area people went to collect strawberries, sites where people went to collect bird eggs in season.
It seems odd that you'd be able to put a site that was, a good berry patch into a historic site selection.
Okay, part of why we take that approach is that that site in itself represents a single activity, but of say, collecting a certain plant species, but put in the context of a whole pattern of seasonal subsistence cycles, that site then plays a very important role in an annual subsistence pattern.
We're taking a very broad perception of what is meant by historic. We're trying to get at it from a more unique rather than etic approach.
Wait a minute.
We're trying to look at Native history more from the perspective of the people there, rather than from the perspective of our culture, mm-hmm. and dealing with history from that kind of an angle, rather than from perhaps the ideas that are more common in our culture about what comprises history.
Yeah, how on earth do you do that, though?
It's a difficult thing to do. obviously, we're not part of our culture.
I think we rely very heavily upon the perspective of our resource specialists. And we'll go load up in the boat and go tour around part of, say, Hinchinbrook Island with them and spend the day observing, what does this resource specialist see as important? What are the sites? What are the locations? What are the aspects of the area that they pick out as being the most important?
Jim Marcotte and Jim Ketch of the Cooperative Park Studies Unit. They worked on 14H1 sites around Prince William Sound. We'll hear about what's happening on the Seward Peninsula and in the interior on the next two programs. I'm Paula Schiller, and this is Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profile, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller with another program looking into the four regions where the Cooperative Park Studies Unit has done work on 14H1 sites. Under ANCSA, the regional corporations are entitled to select historic and culturally significant sites. Every region has its own site characteristics. Some are compact village sites, some are prehistoric. In the case of the Seward Peninsula, some are fairly recent, like those associated with reindeer herding. Bill Shepard spent last summer on the Seward Peninsula and explains that it's up to the people in the region to decide the importance of each site.
What's probably unique about Seward Peninsula is that the way the people have approached the ecology of their area can differ very radically between just a 20-mile area. And so each area around the village has its own uniqueness.
For instance, can you sort of describe something for us?
Well, there are many, many sites which each have an importance to the system. Relatively few sites that, in terms of subsistence, would be outstandingly important because their subsistence system is so varied. They utilize so many resources. But each of these sites, despite the level of contribution, you might say, to the system or the people, is very important.
You need to look at all, several small ones, and it makes up a sort of huge system rather than each site being
That's right. Well, archaeology in the past has tended to look at very large village sites, and that has given a very skewed representation of what things are really like. So there's been a tendency to talk about the significance of a particular site, viewing it in the context of major village sites, like the site on Cape Dendy, which has at least archaeologically become very well known. Neglect the importance of the smaller sites, but that's really an unfair thing to do, and you can't acquire a good understanding of everything that way.
It sounds like kind of an understanding that you're looking at, like the more you find, the more you find the need to find. Is that true, or is that...
Well, you don't need to find everything. No archaeologist attempts to do that. What you need to do is have a sample and try to have that sample representative of all aspects of the culture. Of course, unfortunately, one, we have limitations in terms of what people thought was significant and what they nominated. Some sites are important because they've been traditional fishing sites. Other sites may be the location of a myth, the setting of a myth. There are stories of battles with various enemies and the criteria that we have to work with in terms of assessing the significance of the site is, first of all, whether it's associated with the traditions and cultural practices of the people. And secondly, whether or not people have important feelings about a place. It's a very subjective thing. There are certain things, I think, that help you tell how people have important feelings about site. One of them is just how well the knowledge is preserved over time. I've surveyed sites where the actual use of the site probably stopped around the 20th century. However, the name of the site is preserved, and the way the site was used is preserved as part of the oral history. And I find that one of the most useful ways to deal with that. Another way was just looking at how a site has been used over time, have people repeatedly gone to this place and used it. For reasons that we may not think of as economically rational. Well, people definitely develop attachments over places. And those sites where the actual resources available have changed over time, and those uses have been inappropriate. But people continue to go to these places and develop them for other uses. And, some of this is reflected in the Native allotment process. People have selected their allotments on the basis of their feelings towards the place and how the family or family could use it over time. So if those sites are outside our selection, if there's an increased selection, then of course we things like Native allotments have priority. The intent of it is that important places to people are preserved if they are outside of other avenues of selection where they will not be preserved and protected.
When Congress takes over, where he goes over the documents, he submits there. Is it hard to prove that a place might be important just because people like it or it's you know, favorite place to go, even though it doesn't have any economic rationale behind it? Or is it easier to prove that a grave site or a grave site kind of misgiving?
Well, some of these questions remain unanswered as yet. In the process of getting the reports done, having them go through the various legal channels that need to be done is just beginning. And what we do need are some test cases. In some cases, maybe this will come out in a negative fashion, but that remains to be seen. The criteria that we are dealing with are fairly open. And I think that's good because there is a risk of imposing non-native anthropological archaeological criteria on things which may not coincide with their view of history or culture, and that would be very unfortunate. We have early, where I've worked, we have developed sort of a four-stage methodology. And we usually start off by just in villages, generally talking to people about the site and trying to get some of the, the feeling for the whole area. And when we actually start surveying sites, and we actually informs people how to these places, and we find that the actual being at a site brings back a lot of memories, and in terms of just finding out about one specific place, it's really useful. After that, then we do pretty standard archaeological surveys in cooperation with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And of course, after that, then we go through the process of writing it up.
But the fun part is going up to the site where the people are sitting down.
Drinking a lot of coffee and just talking. And usually we talk about a lot of things related to the site. And find out how one site related to another. For instance, one site may be a place where people have left kayaks for their courage. And then we'll go to another site, and that may have been a lookout for the courage hunters. I've been pretty fortunate in my work that I have gotten some sample of the diversity of the site. that tells you quite a bit. So there's a lot of useful things come out of it along with the preservation of the historic sites. There's useful things to an anthropologist who wants to learn about the area.
And
Well, we have some pretty serious time limitations on what you can put into a report. You, of course, can't do a little ethnography on the area. However, it's very important when talking about the significance of a site to try to capture where the site fits in those cultural traditions. I think you have to demonstrate that before you can talk about significance. So there is not perhaps a picture of the whole culture of a particular area, but some discussion of the aspects of the culture that surround a particular site.
What I hear more often is people that are collecting oral history, any kind of data, is that people come, collect all the stuff, and disappear.
Yeah, that's very true. I'm very conscious of that. If nothing else, I've made a number of friends out there, and I'd like to see them. I think it is a problem with anthropologists have had the gone out, got the information, did their dissertation and got off. It's very important to maintain contact and make people feel that they're part of it all. I think that our job is fortunate in that we can, in the process of going out and doing field work again in the area, renew contact and make people feel they're not exploited. There is a basic value in what we're doing, and it is for them. I think many people realize that, but the project and their participation in it is helping preserve their tradition.
It's kind of fun for everybody involved too to go out there and look at this stuff. Even besides the work aspect and the value of it, I think it's a nice thing to do.
Yeah, you get to see a lot of beautiful places, and meet a lot of interesting people. It's the sort of job that most people would probably pay to go do, at least during the summer.
Bill Shepard of the Cooperative Site Studies Unit. He says it's the winter's paperwork that's the tough part of the job. Next week, we go into the interior. For tonight, I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profile, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. The Cooperative Trust Studies Unit on the University of Alaska campus in Fairbanks is surveying 14H1 sites under a provision of access. The Park Studies unit has published a newsletter about their activities. On the cover is a picture of a survey team and a group of Native resource specialists at Old John's Cabin in Rogers Village. David Libby is in the picture and is part of the team working in the Doyon region.
Rogers Village was just one of the areas, and it's the one that we started in.
Mm-hmm.
With the idea of beginning in the north section of the Doyon area, and then working our way down throughout the next few years. So we're going to spend, we spent last summer, last year, season there. And there are still more sites that we'll have to range out further from the village this year. And we'll be getting into the wildlife range also to completely cover the other village area. And then we'll be moving south from there. Probably not this summer, but next summer. I don't know if where we'll be based after all this goes. Perhaps in the town, or maybe in Fort Lucas.
So there are 21 20 sites in the Oxford area.
We looked at 20 sites last year. We'll be looking at probably 20 more this year. And that's only a very small fraction of the actual number of sites. I couldn't even begin to guess how many hundreds or thousands of sites there would be around outside of Village Area. When we were looking at sites last year, we had to kind of draw the limit at the boundaries of the site because it's almost as if you could walk just from one site to the next and almost have a continuous site on the high ground, just ranging out in any direction from the village. So that we have to limit ourselves.
Mm.
And
we
do that. A lot of them are fishing fish camps. There were probably maybe some hunting camps.
The one that I've been reading about is Old John Cabin.
Yeah, that was one of my most interesting sites and one that's very important to people. The Old John Cabin site is that old ground village. So historically, it's a very important area to the other village people. And old John himself was a very interesting person. He was a seaman who converted to Christianity sometime around the turn of the century, or perhaps in the latter part of the last century. And another man, somewhat older than Old John, but they were friends, a man named Soap Yaw, had previously been to Old Crow, associated with the white men there, the Canadians, and learned how to build a log cabin, what the people refer to as English style, that is the joint, one simple saddle knot, a mortise and pestle at the corners of the building. He learned how to build this type of cabin, came back to Old John Lake, and it wasn't known as Old John Lake at that time, I think it was called Big Lake, and built the first Western style log cabin somewhere in the area of Old John Lake. We don't know exactly where. He later on abandoned that cabin. And Old John disassembled it and moved it down closer to the lake, to an area about a mile up from the lake where the people had always liked to camp, and where Inupiat Eskimo periodically came, particularly around Christmas time, to trade with the Inupiat Eskimo. He set up his cabin, rebuilt his cabin in that spot, was a likely place, and people congregated there, and used it as a kind of Bible school or church to preach the new religion, which the people and the people in the area and the people from the North Coast were quite enthusiastic about the new religion. They were quite interested in the Bible, in the book. And some of the people had learned how to read English from the Bible. It's special to Old John as
Albert Pitt, another very interesting man from the United States area, who also was a seaman, and during a trip to Fort Wooton when he was a young man, he went to the mission service and was quite impressed with the mission, and perhaps with the service itself. He was very interested in the missionary's attempt to put the Christian language into writing using our alphabet. That was one thing that he found very interesting. He went back to our village and in a classic manner went on a solitary trip out to the mountains and had a vision converted to Christianity. And from that time on, he worked at various projects in an attempt to consolidate people into group effort, building up solidarity. The first idea he had was to build a caribou fence. Now, caribou fence is a corral type structure that V's out for several miles in two directions and kind of funnels itself towards the head. And these have historically been used to trap caribou. During the caribou migration times, the people would station themselves under these fences and drive the caribou into them up toward the head where they had snares. And then when the caribou would trap, they would spear them and cut them up there. Well, Albert Pitt's idea was to surround a mountain, a small mountain called Pitchy Gulf, with one of these corral type fences, and then herd the caribou into it, close off the fence, and keep a living herd on tap for the right to its people. He started this project in 1914 and tried to enslave the people in the village to work with him, but he only got one other man in his family to help him. But between the two of them, they built over a mile of fence. They would have had to build probably 7 or 8 more miles of fence to really surround the mountain. They worked on it, I think, three summer seasons. And then he gave up on the project. He wasn't able to get the rest of the people in the village enthusiastic on the idea. He and his helper during the winter lived out near where they were building the fence, and during the winter time they studied the Bible together. Albert Pitt then, a few years later, built the first church in the Albert Village. And he did get the help of other people on that project. He also had a vision of what he got from the Bible, of a straight road going from Albert Village to Fort Wooton. And he did enthuse the people in working on that project, starting to build a straight road from Albert Village to Fort Wooton. A very monumental task. Another task that was abandoned, but they did get several miles of road constructed before they abandoned that project.
When you went to look at Old John's Cabin, what kind of sister did you have to find out what you were looking at for instance, and what was there?
Well, all the sites that we looked at had previously been put on the map. When we went out to Old John's Cabin, we were able to take, very fortunate to be able to take some of the older people who had lived there at the turn of the century. We took Sarah Frank, who now lives in Genotown. She's 94 years old and is a daughter of Old John. And we were able to take Myra Kay, who was visiting from Old Crow, She's approximately 97 years old, and is a niece of Coach Brown, the original builder of the cabin. We had several other people with us, too, who had been related to old Brown, but these were the oldest people that we had. And both Myra and Sarah Frank had lived in the cabin when they were kids. So they were able to tell us a lot about the history of the place and about its significance. We traveled around in a helicopter last summer, so it was relatively easy to take anyone that we needed out of sight. We could fly into the village and pick up these elderly people who otherwise probably never would have taken a chance to go back to these sites and take them right out there on the spot. Old man's wife, Sarah Frank's mother, had died near old man's cabin, probably around 1950, we don't know the date exactly, and Sarah had never been to the grave since the time of the burial, so we were able to follow around the grave, and she was quite happy to be there. Otherwise, probably never would have seen her mother's grave again.
It looks like Clarence got pictures from when he got about old John's cabin, and anybody took her having it. Probably my friend took her around the old cabin and talking about it.
Yeah, they did. They had a very great time. They were able to take, let's see. I think it must be about 10 of the older people. That we were able to take up there in that helicopter. And one of the ladies, as soon as she got out of the helicopter, had a bunch of tracks, and then 22 yards later, she went off looking for a good place to set up the tracks for brown squirrels. The older people in the area really liked to eat brown squirrels. And one of the reasons that old John liked that particular locality for the cabin was because it was known for as a good tracking place for ground squirrels. So Alice Peter, once she got out of the helicopter, immediately went out to try to get some ground squirrels. Steven Libby.
David Libby of the Cooperative Press Studies Unit. And this is the last of a series looking at what the anthropologists and archaeologists are doing in the region for their civilian 1481 site. Fort Smith, I'm Paula Schiller. And this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.